We have we've actually had a very busy week this week, and we have two other I think very interesting events coming up on the 21st of this month. We've got Simon Young talking about, don't laugh, electing Hong Kong's chief executive in 2012. I think he has some more interesting things to say about this. And on the I've given you the wrong date. That's on the 28th. All these dates are a bit weird here. And on the 7th of, I presume, next month, although it doesn't say it here, we've got Pavin Chachavalongpun, something like that, for people who speak Thai, who's talking about when Thaksin ruled the world, reviewing his blotch diplomacy. Talking of blotch diplomacy, we now move to China. As you see, rarely in a map in this part of the world where China isn't in the center of things. Very happy to welcome Robert Sutter, who at the moment is a visiting professor of Asian Studies at the School of Foreign Service in Georgetown University. He is hardly new to this subject. He's been in various governmental organizations, writing about Asia, studying Asia for the past 33 years. His most recent book, published in 2008, is The United States in Asia. Today he's talking about China's rise in Asia and in world affairs. So please welcome Robert Sutter.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's a great pleasure for me to be here today and to give you a perspective on China's rise in Asia. This is something I've been working on as an academic for about 8 or 9 years. And much of the most important evidence that I've found comes from government officials that I've interacted with in private discussions over the last 6 or 7 years. These government officials, there are about 180 of them, in 10 Asian Pacific countries, including China. And what it does is give me an insight into China's rise in Asia, which I want to share with people. And I've written a lot about this issue, but I'm welcome the opportunity to summarize it for you today. And there's a couple of things that I would emphasize in this situation. The first thing is that China's rise in Asia is something that's very important in determining China's role in the world. For China to be a great power in the world, they're going to have a secure position in Asia. And yet their position in Asia is and remains very complicated. China remains encumbered in Asia. And so I'm going to look at that for a minute, and then I'm going to move and compare China in Asia with the United States in Asia. That might be a useful comparison to think about. So let's take a look at the first situation. One thing, I've just come from a 2-week speaking tour in China, and one thing people don't focus on much in China is China's legacy in Asia. From the point of view of the officials I talked with and many others and the evidence, China for 4 decades was one of the most disruptive forces in Asia. And this is something that's historically accurate, and yet it isn't discussed because we're in a phase in the last 2 decades of China rising more peacefully and cooperatively. But in the background, in the minds of Asian officials, this has a tremendous impact. China has a great difficulty in living down the past. The second point is looking at China in Asia is China has been rising in Asia from a peaceful point of view. And this is working well for China, and we're going to deal with that very soon. But as China advances, we can look at the record and see how China is doing in Asia. Is China the leading power in Asia? Is the U.S. in decline? Is China now the leading country in the region? Right, let's take a look at the record. Today, China's relations with Japan versus a few years ago, are they better or worse? They're better. Are they a lot better? No. Is Japan a big problem for China? Obviously. China-India relations. Are relations with China today better than they were 6 or 7 years ago? Short answer, no, they're worse. It's not that they're bad, but they're worse. They're not as good as they were. China-Russia relations. I think arguably you could even say that China-Russia relations are somewhat worse than they were 6 or 7 years ago. Then you take the smaller, the not quite so powerful countries in Asia, like South Korea. China relations with South Korea today versus 6 or 7 years ago, they're worse than they were 6 or 7 years ago. Australia, 6 or 7 years ago, China's relations today are worse than they were 6 or 7 years ago. It's not that they're terrible, but they're worse. And looking at Southeast Asia, where China has made lots of inroads in the Southeast Asian area, you find that China has made progress in a lot with a lot of different governments, and yet the dynamics of the region are influenced by a great deal of confusion on the part of leading countries in Southeast Asia, like Thailand and the Philippines. And you find that the traditional power of Southeast Asia, the biggest country, Indonesia, is reemerging to its leadership position. And I think if you look at this perspective, you see that Indonesia is the country in Southeast Asia that's least likely to bandwagon with China. And so my basic point here underlines a point that a Chinese senior foreign ministry official told me in 2006. I said, does China want to be the leading power of Asia? Does China want to dominate Asia? And he said to me, China can't dominate Asia. There are too many governments in Asia. And I think he's right. It's a very complicated environment. And so China, as it rises in the world, is rising in an environment that's very complicated by these very independent-minded governments in Asia. And it makes it difficult for China to be secure in its environment as it reaches out in Europe and Africa and other parts of the world. And I think this process will be long in evolving. Now let's take another look at this situation, looking at it from a comparative perspective. And this is looking at the strengths of the rising power, China, and taking a look and assessing it and comparing it to the United States, which has been the leading power of Asia. Is a power transition underway? Is the United States in decline and China is the new power center of Asia? Let's look at this carefully. And when we do this, I think it's important as an analyst, I've been an analyst throughout my career, as an analyst looking at this, we need to consider not only the strengths of the rising power and the weaknesses of the United States, we also need to consider the limitations of the rising power, China, and the strengths of the United States. And this is where my interviews have been very helpful in giving me some understanding of the strengths of the United States, because this is not written about very much, and I want to share that with you. So let's look at China's strengths. China's strengths are heavily economic and diplomatic. And we all, I think we're very familiar with this. It's a very big trader. And so trade's very important. Investment is very important. Lots of Asian investment goes to China. Very little of Chinese investment goes to Asia. But this is a binding force between China and the countries of Asia. Chinese diplomacy, excellent, both bilaterally and multilaterally. Excellent diplomacy, first rate, and also with their leaders. Their leaders are very effective in dealing with this in this regard. And they follow win-win diplomacy. China has cultural influence in Asia, very important. And there are ethnic Chinese in various countries in Asia which are positive forces for China in the region. All of these are very positive forces for China. What about Chinese limitations and weaknesses? Well, China's legacy in Asia, as I said, tends to be negative. And China has a lot to live down with the various countries of Asia. I don't have time to go into the details. It's a little bit of a history lesson, but it's very important, it seems to me. Patriotism. Chinese people are very patriotic. They're nationalistic. But so are most of the government and the peoples in Asia. And this makes issues very contentious. So if you have territorial issues or other disputes, even history disputes, other things like that, makes it very difficult for China to make a lot of headway because it's hard to compromise. Both sides have a hard time compromising. China's military expansion, this is a power, this is a force, a positive force for China in the region, but it's something that China doesn't talk about very much because they want to reassure the governments of Asia and the United States about their approach. But it also is a negative because it makes a lot of the governments in Asia a bit suspicious about China in the region. The authoritarian system of China is also somewhat negative from the point of view of some governments in Asia, not all by any means. And then we have trade, the area of strength. But this trade, as we all know, is heavily, half of China's trade is controlled by foreign invested enterprises in China. It's very interdependent. Half of China's trade is processing trade, where the commodity goes back and forth across the border, and it's often finished in China and sometimes consumed there, used there, but it's often exported elsewhere. And the big markets for China are the European Union and the United States. And so it's a heavily interdependent type of trade. It makes it very difficult to throw your weight around in this kind of trading relationship. Investment is one way. This is fine for the Asian investors. They make money. The Asian governments tend to be okay with this. But the laboring forces in these various countries don't like this. They don't get the investment in their country, and they are put at some disadvantage. And then you get diplomacy. And diplomacy of China is very successful, and it works sort of like this. The Chinese official will go to a government and say, what do you want? And the government says, we want six things. And the Chinese say, we agree with 3.5 of those. So let's talk about those. And they agree, and they have communiques, and they agree on everything they agree on. And what does this mean? Well, the Chinese go to this government and they say, we want to have good relations with you, and we don't require you to do anything you wouldn't ordinarily do. A couple of exceptions, Taiwan and the Dalai Lama, but otherwise this is the case. But what does this mean for China? It means that China isn't required to do anything it wouldn't ordinarily do. And so, ladies and gentlemen, I'm coming back to this. China doesn't do risk, cost, or commitment that it wouldn't ordinarily do. And so this is well known in the region and something we'll come back to in a minute. The Chinese, ethnic Chinese in Southeast Asia are a positive force for China, but they're also a negative force viewed with some suspicion as far as Indonesia and Malaysia and other countries are concerned. Okay, let's take a look at the United States. The United States has lots of problems in Asia. I've done speaking through trips throughout Asia over the last decade. Every time I went on a trip, every country I went to, except maybe with China, they denounced the United States widely. Somehow in China they liked George Bush, but everywhere else they didn't like him at all. And so the U.S. image was just horrible throughout the region. The disputes were enormous. And so the image of the United States really was in decline, no question about it. This criticism of U.S. foreign policy tended to be the main weakness of the United States. What are U.S. strengths? Nobody writes about U.S. strengths. I'm a scholar. It's hard to get footnotes on U.S. strengths. It's these scholars that told me, it's these officials that told me about it, these foreign government officials. They said, and this is what it boils down to. There are two sets of strengths, which you can watch, and I hope you will watch, to see if the U.S. is in decline or not. The first one is security. Let me explain. In Asia, governments matter. They make the decisions. The media, the public opinion, it influences these decisions, but at the end of the day, these government officials are very calculating and they make their own decisions. What do they want? Basically, they want development. And what do they need to have development? They need a stable environment. Is Asia stable? In their view, no. It's not threatening, usually, but it's not stable. They don't trust each other. Disagreements you see between China and Japan publicly are emblematic throughout the region. And so where are they going to get stability? Well, they look at me coming from the United States, and this is what some of them say. It's this strange country. It's far away. And it's willing to spend $50 to $100 billion a year to maintain a security presence in this region to keep stability in Asia. And the young people in this country are willing to sign up for their military and get killed if necessary to keep stability in Asia. He says, this is very strange. There's no one else that will do this, and we need it. Now, the United States does this, obviously, for its own interest, but it has a broad sense of its interest in this regard. Now, I'm speaking here not as a U.S. representative. I'm speaking here as a scholar and an analyst looking at this situation. This is what these people say. And I think they're right. So this is something you can measure. Is this in decline? Is the U.S. not doing this? And who else will do it? Is China doing this? Is any other country in Asia doing this in any significant way? I think, take a look. Win-win diplomacy for China means they have to win. has to work for China. They're very focused on China. I'm not criticizing China. It's not exceptional. Most governments are like this. But the point is that that's the reality. Okay, the second thing to look at is economics. These governments often rely on export-oriented growth. And so they need to export. And they understand these webs of trading relationships in Asia lead to a lot of intra-Asian trade, but ultimately a lot of it depends on export out of the region. And they see the United States, with its open markets, willing to absorb a trade deficit with Asia in 2008 of $350 billion at a time of an overall American trade deficit of $700 billion. And these officials will say, and we need that. And so this is the second thing that you can measure. The C, is the United States becoming protectionist? Will this change in a significant way? China, as you all know, runs a trade surplus. And so other strengths of the United States, George Bush did a good job of managing relations with China and Japan, China with India and Pakistan, with Taipei and Beijing. This is all positive. And also America, it's very important to understand America versus China and some other governments. American interaction with Asia is heavily non-governmental. The webs of relationships that America has with Asia are enormous, and having nothing to do with the government. And so I work at Georgetown University. We have all sorts of exchanges with Asia. But I'm thinking in terms of business, I'm thinking in terms of religious groups, I'm thinking in terms of foundations, and this has been going on for decades and centuries in some cases. Meanwhile, America has changed its very bad immigration policy in 1965, and millions of Asians have come to America as immigrants. To be an immigrant in the United States is not easy, but they have settled down, and these people are Americans, and at the same time, they're very powerful forces in dealing with various countries in Asia. And then there's one final strength of the United States, which I'd like to underline, which I think is very important for my approach, and that is the role of the U.S. Pacific Command and the security apparatus of the United States. They are advanced, and they're pretty good at diplomacy. They work quietly with all sorts of governments in Asia. And what do they have going for them? Well, they do training. They do education. The U.S. military is really good. The U.S. intelligence apparatus isn't bad. And so when these people have a problem, like they have, oh, out there in the forest, we've got these terrorists. Well, they say, well, we've got intelligence on those terrorists. We can tell you about them. Or we have a machine that can find them for you at night. And so they say, wow, this is great. You know, this type of cooperation. So the U.S. military, for a variety of reasons, is welcomed by a whole range of governments in the region, very quietly building relationship. And a big imperative, a big reason for this, is China's rise. Because as these countries see China rising, they are, as I said, independent-minded governments. They want to keep the initiative in their own hands. They want to work positively with China. But they say, what does China want ultimately? They're not sure. Would China be dominating? Maybe. So what do? They engage in contingency plans. What if China was assertive? And so what they do is tell the American Pacific Command, tell the U.S. security apparatus, and tell in other ways too, they do this, they tell the Americans, stay close. Don't go away. Just stay. Be here. Let's interact. Let's do a lot of different things together. And you be here. And that's the dynamic that plays to the strength of the United States in the region, it seems to me. And so when I add it all up, I see a picture of China in Asia encumbered as it tries to rise in the region. It's very complicated. As my Chinese foreign ministry friend said, he says, this is going to take us a long time to rise to prominence in Asia. And what I see, they're doing it in an environment where the U.S. remains the leading power of Asia. And the foundation of U.S. leadership are those two things, which involve risk, cost, and commitment. And China is not prepared to do that. What does China do as far as risk, cost, and commitment that it wouldn't ordinarily do? I'm with China experts here. Did you know that China receives a lot of foreign assistance? We hear a lot about China granting assistance. Did you know it receives a lot? Anybody know that? They do. $1.5 billion a year to the World Bank. Did you know that? From the World Bank. Every year. Asian Development Bank, $1.35 billion from the Asian Development Bank. The last figures I have for the European Union was about $400 million a year. The UN has 24 programs here in China, assisting the China. They just announced a new five-year plan for these assistance programs. Each large developed country in the OECD has a aid program with China. And China's still taking it all in. Why? Because it's a developing country. And so, yes, China's rising. Yes, it's very important. Does China rule Asia? No. Does China rule the world? I think if they can't rule Asia, they're not going to be ruling the world. Asia's the area where they've had the most power. And is the United States in decline? Well, maybe. But you can watch. Take a look. Is the U.S. withdrawing? And is the U.S. protectionist? Those are the key foundations of U.S. strength and leadership in Asia. So I know this is a little counterintuitive. This is from somebody that's been working this issue for about 8 years. I'm a little nerdy. I look at the facts. And I welcome any insights you might have on this one, because I'm constantly working this issue, trying to figure out exactly what's happening. To me, it's very important for Americans to get this issue right. If Americans think China is really powerful and it could be a really big problem for the United States, they may react quite differently to China. And I don't want to see that unless it's based on facts. And the facts that I see are as I have laid out for you. So I welcome your questions and comments the way I look at the situation. And thank you for your attention.
Richard Volstack from the American Chamber of Commerce.
Where are you?
Here.
There you go. Good to see you.
Question that's kind of timely, but also I wonder how it fits in with the trade strengths of both China and the United States, is the labor issue. Do you see, is the genie out of the box in China on labor disputes and labor concerns, which has always been a traditional concern for China, how that of impact by that of going forward on China's trade strength and retention of being a workshop of the world? And counter to that, one of the biggest concerns seems to be in the United States that the labor movement in the United States is anti-trade. And so how do you see the labor component of China's rise and American strength playing out in the near future?
Thanks for your question, Richard. Good to see you. On the labor impact in China, don't you think the publicity of the labor disputes, we've had labor disputes, a lot of them over the years in China. It's gotten the attention of the West in a fairly big way recently. I'm not sure if this is really that unusual, but what we do see is obviously creeping wages, wage hikes in China. And so the competitiveness of China is in decline in that regard. But of course, China's moving up the value chain, aren't they? I mean, I'm not a specialist in this, but I think that the challenge of China will be in different areas rather than labor-intensive type of industries. I've just finished this book on China in Africa. And China, who invests in Africa? These are sunset industries of China investing in Africa. So they're following the pattern that Taiwan and Korea and others have followed in dealing with the labor issues. And I think they will still remain, they will be even more of an economic challenge, because they'll be moving up the value chain and producing goods that are very competitive with very advanced countries. So for China, as the health of its economy, I think this is not a big negative. On labor in the United States, this is very interesting, and the Democratic Party gets support from organized labor. It's a very important part of the Democratic Party, but it's a minority. And Mr. Obama has shown that he seems to be following a policy where he has to listen to organized labor, and he wants their support on a variety of issues, like health care and other things like that. But is he protectionist? Well, I think what you have seen, what I've seen at least, in my judgment, is he's made some gestures to them, small issues dealing with China, tires and steel rods and things like that, which using WTO agreements with China to do this type of thing to limit surges. I don't see fundamental protectionist policies coming yet from the United States government, and I think that the Obama people seem to be resistant to that. They're trying to manage this tension while keeping support from labor, not do too much for them, and not do too much for them in the sense that it would be contrary to U.S. efforts to revitalize the global economy and keep the American economy going strong. The thing I have big questions about, and you can see from my analysis and my presentation, is the rebalancing. Are we really going to rebalance? How long is that going to take? I mean, it seems to me that the U.S. will still remain the focal point of exports from Asia. And my sense is the United States will still have a big trade deficit with Asia. And so the rebalancing, I think, is going to be a long-term proposition. But as far as labor, organized labor and its influence, I think they are more protectionist, they are more concerned with jobs. But I don't think that's the mainstream view in the Obama government.
Thank you, Professor Sutter. This is Deirdre Lowe from Hill & Associates. Thank you for your talk. It's nicely provocative. Just want to ask, I'm here. The question is, your presentation didn't address the role of the currency, of the US dollar. And I was wondering if you were to include that into your consideration, perhaps the increased circulation of the yuan versus the U.S. dollar. Would that affect your analysis at all?
Thank you for your question. I have tried to consider the importance of the U.S. dollar and the currency issue, and so you're arguing that the yuan will take its place? Is that the... If the yuan
circulation.
In circulation. Yeah.
And
what sort of a challenge this
would that affect?
Yes.
Would that affect the
obviously that would have an effect. Most of the analysis that I've read suggests that this will be a very long-term proposition of the yuan ever getting to that stage. Could happen. The yen has been around for a long time, and a lot of people talked about that for many years. That was a big issue back in the 90s and the 80s. So let's wait to see. What we found is that in 2000, just for reference, for 2009, we found that senior Chinese officials publicly were talking about China moving in this direction. And then they stopped. They stopped. I haven't seen them do it recently. So I think they've had seconds. Maybe, I don't know what caused them to stop, but they did stop. And so I think they're still very dependent on the dollar. They're still buying U.S. securities. It's these threats that came out in 2009. They just stop.
Yeah. Thank you. David O'Rear from the General Chamber of Commerce. Taiwan doesn't seem to be all that interested in its own national defense. Japan is raising serious issues about military bases in Okinawa. And Korea's never really been all that comfortable with a large American military presence, but obviously recent events have probably caused them to be quite grateful for that. Do you see Asian nations, particularly those who have a history of conflict with China, just assuming they'll get a free ride from the U.S. armed forces, or are they taking a pragmatic approach that you can't possibly beat China its own game, so why bother?
Or something else, right? You know, this is very interesting. And you've got sort of apples and oranges in a way in the case of Taiwan, because Taiwan isn't in the same category as Japan or Korea, in the sense that the United States has defense agreements with both Japan and Korea, and has U.S. forces on the, lots of U.S. forces on the ground in both countries. And I think the dynamics in Japan and the dynamics in Korea now, as you point out, it could change, are pretty strong to keep those relationships. Public opinion in Japan is very favorable toward the alliance. Are they free riding? I think a lot of criticism in the past in the United States on Japan for free riding was quite obvious. But I think that as long as Japan is willing to bear the burden of the bases and to do its host nation support and be supportive of the United States in other ways, this asymmetrical alliance relationship that the United States has with Japan will continue, and I don't think it will be widely seen as free riding. In the Korean case, of course, as you noted, even before the Chonan incident, the Korean-American relationship was very close. Mr. Obama and Mr. Lee really have a very close relationship. It's a very positive thing from the American alliance point of view. Now, will it last? Obviously, Mr. Lee is a conservative, and if the more left of center people reemerge in leading South Korea, this presumably could change. Korea is a divided polity on these kinds of issues. But for now, I think this alliance is really very close and very strong. In the case of Taiwan, the U.S. is helping, supporting Taiwan as it manages this relationship with China, and it's following a reassurance policy. And I think I don't know how the American government judges this. This is based on the statements that I've seen them make, and it is a sense of relief that the tumultuous period of 1995 until 2008 is over. This is very dangerous for the United States. I mean, the policies that Taiwan was following risked war. I was an American official for the first half of that period, and I was amazed at how worried people were about war with China over Taiwan. Well, that has abated. That's a big plus. Mr. Ma Ying-jeou has done a big thing for the United States in reducing that danger. So are they free riding? Maybe in one respect they are, but this is a great sense of relief from the American point of view about the danger of war with China over Taiwan, because Taiwan is moving toward independence. Mr. Ma is not moving toward independence, and he's reassuring China on this issue. So when you add it all up, I think that the Japanese are doing a lot, and probably as long as they continue to do that, I think that won't be a big issue in the United States. The Koreans are doing more than ever. The Koreans are in the lead in so many different issues, nuclear proliferation issues and G20, all these types of things that Mr. Obama once is seeking help with, the Koreans are standing up and doing the help and doing the things that Mr. Obama wants. The relationship is very close. In the case of Taiwan, Mr. Ma Ying-jeou isn't beefing up his defense very much, but he's certainly following a policy that eases the burden of the United States in dealing with Taiwan, at least in the short term.
Professor Sata, I'm Venki Wimbe for Daily News and Analysis. It's a newspaper that comes out of India. When we look at Asia, there's another elephant in the room, and I refer to India. Also 1 billion people, it's an open liberal democracy. It doesn't have the historical legacy in Asia that you say China has. Do you think its rise counts for anything in Asian and global affairs, or is it completely irrelevant?
Goodness. India is far from irrelevant. It's a focal point of attention. If you look at U.S. policy statements in dealing with India, what is the goal of the United States? The goal of the United States is to help India become a major power in the world. The U.S. explicitly says this. This is what they want, for India to be this great power in the world. And of course, there's a lot of security relationships, strategic dialogues, and other things. This isn't what the Americans say about, the American government says about China. They say a strong, peaceful China is in the interest of everybody. But they don't say, we want this. But the U.S., for, as far as India is concerned, says we want this. So the relevance of India for the United States, I think, is very high. And it's a very, it's in a very sensitive area of the world as far as Afghanistan and Pakistan, and that critical, high-priority security interest for the United States as well. So in U.S. policy, I think it's a very high salience.
Martin Sabine, I'm working in finance, I'm not a journalist. But you made certain financial points, for example, the strength of the US as an importing market which benefits Asian countries. I think, though, the consumer story is a little bit yesterday's story. And if you look at your map there and you're looking at the major infrastructure work going on, which a lot of China's efforts has been switched from consumer products to major heavy engineering infrastructure. If you want to get a dam built somewhere, if you want to build a high-speed railway, if you want to drill an oil field, if you want to develop an iron ore mine, what you're finding is the money is coming from China. And not merely the money, but the expertise to do it. And maybe in the past, the US, you'd have had Bechtel, you'd have had Carlyle doing the financing, you'd have had Exxon doing the oil fields, no more. Even in Philippines or Indonesia, if you look at the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, you'll see those projects, infrastructure projects, mining projects, they all want a Chinese cornerstone investor, and they want Chinese banks to finance, and the Chinese banks are financing. If you look yesterday, a big Russian, the biggest aluminium company in the world, Rusal, came to Hong Kong for its AGM. It's listed here because it says it wants to sell the aluminium to China, and its refineries are all in Siberia. It makes sense, but 5 years ago, certainly they'd have floated on Wall Street. So, are you missing in your facts a shift here that if you're looking at Asia and you're looking at a map, how can America compete any more for technical and financial resources? And again, just looking at your map, China is near enough a middle there. Isn't the one snag for your thesis that America isn't actually in Asia? So it can influence Asia, it can, to be unkind, meddle in Asia, but on a 5 to 10 view, how can it be a leading power in Asia?
Thank you for your input and your very useful remarks. I don't have a good answer for that in Asia because I don't have as comprehensive a database as you seem to have. I've just completed a review of Africa, China and Africa, and when you often look at, I agree, on the infrastructure side along the rim of China, it's dominant. Yes, China is dominant in that area. So all along the rim of China, and particularly in Southeast Asia, it's a very, very important player in that regard. I'd add that some of that infrastructure is being built with other people's funds, like the Asian Development Bank and others. But yes, this is a big fact. And China has lots of money to do this kind of thing. And so one has to look at it and say, well, how important is this? And you have to compare it with what else is going on in the region. I don't have at hand exactly what is going on in the other parts of the Asia at this time. What I see in Africa is that China is very important in doing just these kinds of things in Africa. But it's in an atmosphere where the European Union and the United States and their private banks from those and private funders in those areas are still much more important than China in Africa. And so you need to add up not just what the Exim Bank of China is doing, you need to add up what are the various Western banks doing in this area. What is the and what are world donors doing in these areas? So, as far as China being more important than the United States in that aspect, yes, I would imagine it is, but I don't have the exact figures. And so, is that an area of strength for the United States? I'm not sure. Has it been? Is this an area where the United States has been deeply involved? I'm not sure. I mean, has the U.S. been the infrastructure leader of Southeast Asia? I don't think so. U.S. interest in Southeast Asia has been focused heavily on maritime Southeast Asia, down not along the rim of China. And so China's always been the dominant power along the rim of China. So I don't know. These are just comments. I'm sorry, I'm not able to make an assessment. I think what one would have to do is add it up and But I don't think the, I'm not sure that you, but you, you, you're assuming that, I think, you may be assuming, that the U.S. was the lead in this regard. And I'm not sure that ever, is that, the, is that true? I'm not sure.
Francis. Francis Moriarty, FCC Board. On the question of cost and risk and commitment, 2 points here. How do you view the decision of the Chinese to become involved in the whole operation off Somalia, which is a cost and is a commitment, and there is risk, and it is functioning as a player, and has said it even wants to be the coordinator or leader of some of the ships in the area. To that, the question of this administration's own comfort level and level of trust with the Chinese government, because subsequent to the very, I would think, at least outwardly unsuccessful trip of the president to China, we've seen the visit of the Dalai Lama to the White House with the photograph and the map room. There's been the arms sales to Taiwan, et cetera. I'm wondering whether the president's experience has perhaps shifted the administration's view in any way in its dealings with China, in your view.
Mm-hmm. I agree that China has seen it's in its interest to do this enterprise in the off of Somalia. And this does involve cost and commitment and risk. And it's joining, how many countries are doing this? 20? 25, 30? I mean, they do that. And it's important. I don't want to downgrade it. I don't know how, and there's a lot of benefits for China in doing this. And I think the United States probably welcomes this sort of thing. China's very helpful. It's not that China's doing risk, cost, and commitment is going to be, it's a zero-sum game where you look at this as against the United States. I think this could be very very much welcomed by the United States. I think it is welcomed by the United States as part of the effort to contain piracy in that dangerous part of the world. Now, you help me with the second part of your question was?
The question is, we had the visit.
Oh, yeah, the state of U.S.
Has there been a shift? Because we saw the statements by Secretary of State Clinton, et cetera, which indicated a certain direction on human rights that many Obama supporters were unhappy with.
Right.
Then there's the visit to China, and then we get the visit by the Dalai Lama, and we get the arms sales to Taiwan. What's the administration's own trust and comfort level with China and its intentions?
You know, this is, it's very, you're right. You get these episodic glimpses of what the U.S. is doing with China. And it's even more complicated from my point of view in the sense that, and again, I'm just speaking as an individual. I'm not speaking as any sort of representative of the U.S. government. You get these complicated situations where both the American government and the Chinese government, in general, when they talk with one another, they emphasize the positive. They hardly ever talk about the negative publicly. And yet we have all these differences with China, and we never really talked about them in public, at least in recent years. We haven't done much of this. It comes up, it bubbles up to the surface once in a while. But we had, 200 officials in China in the SED? Did anybody see anything negative transpire between these two? There was this report of the military guy talking to the SED, but that was about it. Everything is positive, and the official commentary was always positive. And yet we have all these differences between the United States and China. So you're referring to some of the differences we have. And I think the Obama approach, as I've distilled it and tried to summarize it, the approach of the Obama government toward China seems to be, is he's seeking support from China as he seeks support from just about every large country in the world to deal with salient issues of the world that are important to the United States. So nuclear proliferation, terrorism, the economy, world economy, and climate change. These are important to Obama, and he's going around the world trying to work with Russia, trying to work with Egypt, trying to work with Indonesia, trying to work with all sorts of governments and China to build cooperation, India, so that he can have some forward movement will be achieved in these areas. That's the basic thrust of what I think he's trying to do. Now, with China, there's a lot of reporting that he's sort of been stiff-armed. Things haven't worked out real well with the Chinese. They're slow in responding. They focused on win-win. They have to win on their side. And so this, maybe he's losing patience with China. I don't think so. I think he will continue to try this kind of effort. As far as these differences over arms sales and over Tibet, really,
at how he handled this issue. Is everybody familiar with the Tibet background? He met with the Dalai Lama in February, was it, of this year? But he was going to China in November. So what does he do? The Dalai Lama came to Washington in October, early October. Wouldn't it have been great for Obama to meet with the Dalai Lama in October and then go to China in November? There might not have been a China visit. So what did he do? Now, this is getting a little bit in the weeds, but I thought it was brilliant. They sent Valerie Jarrett. Now, this audience, probably most of you don't know who Valerie Jarrett is. Valerie Jarrett is probably the third most important person in the White House. Very close friend of Mr. Obama. They sent Valerie Jarrett to the headquarters of the Dalai Lama in India. She led the delegation to explain to the Dalai Lama, unfortunately, we can't meet you in October. We're going to have to delay the meeting. Did they say because of the China visit? No, but it was obviously for that. And so he tried very hard to neutralize this issue, which he had to do, for the sake of keeping on a good relationship with China. And we found arms sales to Taiwan. The arms sales that were transferred were basically the second half of the package that the Bush administration sold to China before they left office. Long-standing commitment to these arms. And he waited till after the November meeting the visit to China, to go forward with the arms sales. Everybody knew, and Washington knew, this was going to happen. It was just a matter of when. And so the Chinese, for their part, decided to make an issue of this in public, more than they normally do, particularly on the arms sales issue. Repeated, the media handled this in a very different way than they normally handle this type of thing. People in China got really spun up on this because there was so much publicity about it. But from my point of view, Mr. Obama is trying to be moderate in dealing with China on both of these questions. And I thought he went to extraordinary efforts to do so in a way that wouldn't be offensive to the Chinese leadership. And the Chinese chose to make a big issue out of it. And so you have to ask yourself, why? And that's something we haven't figured out, we and analysts in Washington. We haven't figured out, why did the Chinese make this big deal out of it? Now, some people say it's because China's assertive now, and they see the U.S. as weak. If you looked at the Chinese media and how they portrayed Obama dealing with Hu Jintao, there's Wen Jiabao. Wen Jiabao is standing there just like this gentleman here, sort of arms folded like this, you see, looking very dignified. And Obama is bowing and sort of gesturing in a way that's like a supplicant, you see. And they like this image, it seems. They get a lot of publicity in the Chinese media. And so maybe they see him as weak. I don't think he's weak, but maybe they see that. And so the upshot of this is that we don't know why the Chinese made a big issue out of this. The grounds for it were much less than in previous visits of the Dalai Lama or previous arms sales. And yet they did. So. But you notice that they have stopped making an issue of this? I mean, they still make it, the military still makes an issue of the arms sales, but not much has happened as a result of either one of these things. Hu Jintao came to the nuclear summit. This was in dispute whether he would come to the nuclear summit in the United States. He came. Everything went according to plan, it seemed. And we don't see a lot. We see, you know, glimpses of this kind of pressure from China, but we don't see a lot of this sort of thing. So, but I'm watching it. We're puzzled in Washington. Why did they make such a big issue out of this when they, in the past they wouldn't have? And it was obvious that Mr. Obama was going out of his way to do these things that are differences with China in a way that would be least offensive to the Chinese administration.
Okay, we've got time just to squeeze in one more question from Neil.
I'm sorry to go on for long.
Hi, Neil Weston from Bloomberg. So returning to South Asia, many Indian academics and politicians are much more fearful of China's rise than perhaps you are. They see the investment in Sri Lanka, in Gwadar, deep sea port in Pakistan, the copper mine in Afghanistan, bases in the Maldives, which they need to secure supply routes for their commodities imports, but also may have a longer-term geopolitical military advantage as well. Are they paranoid, or should they be afraid?
It's a good question. What are China's objectives in South Asia? Historically, China has relied on Pakistan as a way to hobble India. And that seems to be, China's relations with Pakistan continue. And so that presumably, from the Indian perspective, I assume that, that calculus continues. And China is a more important actor in international economic matters, as was talked about earlier with the infrastructure. It has all these contracting companies, these labor contract companies that are all over the world building these various things. And they finance these things. The Koreans did this for a long time. They were very active in doing this labor contract type of work. Now the Chinese are in the lead in doing these kinds of things in South Asia and Africa, as well as in other parts of Asia and the world. And they're very competitive, and they do a good job, and they get the contracts, and they build these various things. Is this part of some conspiracy on the part of China to wedge in India? Some Indians think that, for sure. In my interviews, underline that point. But I don't think that these commercial aspects are really that serious. As a strategic type of situation. I think much of this is commercial. The Chinese company, it's a very competitive environment. Chinese has all these companies, they want to go out, they want to make money, and they do this kind of thing. And so it's a mix, obviously. The Chinese do strategically still value very much their relationship with Pakistan. Part of that value is the effect this has on India, and their relationships with Bangladesh and with Sri Lanka and others play into this to some degree. Is China prepared to compete with India in South Asia as the leading power in South Asia? I don't think so. The Chinese Navy may be taking an interest in this part of the world in the future, but they have a long way to go before they'll have a capability to do major things in the South Asian area, and particularly to compete with India, which is, of course, advancing its military a lot. And so you have this sort of wary relationship between China and India. Nobody wants to fight, but they're suspicious of one another. And this is something that, as I tried to indicate in my remarks, plays to the advantage of the United States, which is not really desirous of hedging, of containing China in any significant way or anything like that. But the U.S. does want to build a good relationship with India, and this aspect of South Asian dynamics assists the United States in that effort.
Well, Robert Sutter, thank you very much indeed. I have to say it's particularly interesting to hear a point of view that we don't, I think, hear so much, particularly in Hong Kong these days. Before you go, you know the old maxim about beware of journalists giving gifts. We would like to give you a gift.